We are talking once again with Maria Tomczyk, local writer and activist, here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good morning.
Good afternoon.
And good afternoon, if you're on the other side of the timeline. So no job this week. He is
recuperating from a fall.
Yeah, he fell.
Yeah. On that night we had that heavy, heavy rain. It was dark. It was slippery. I fell on that night.
Was that the blood moon?
That was the blood moon. Yes, I fell on that night. And I was okay. Job was not as okay. So he's recuperating.
So, in the meantime, the locally and across the U.S., it's been a election circus.
It has been. It's been a really interesting election. The mainstream media has been heavily focused on what they term kind of the midterm blowback. Typically, whoever has the White House and whoever controls Congress, whichever party controls Congress, will in the midterms between presidential elections will suffer a setback in the midterm election. So typically the opposition party can make, that's a time when the opposition party can make big gains. And that's held true for most presidencies throughout the 20th century and into the 21st century. This time was the exception. And we'll talk a little bit more when we talk about the national elections. But I found it kind of interesting that even here in Washington State, where we know, right, that we're pretty much a blue state, that the mainstream media here was warning, oh, you know, these Democratic incumbents, they could be upset by these Republican challengers. And that just didn't happen. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the results in some of the races here locally. First off, we have our U.S. Senator, Patty Murray. There were a lot of warnings that Tiffany Smiley could unseat her, you know, and that didn't happen. Murray's won a decisive victory over Smiley by taking 57% of the vote to Smiley's 43% as of Friday night.
Although I'm still surprised that, you know, Smiley could pull off 43%.
Could pull off that much. And I think, as I've said in the past, there's some ageism and some sexism involved, I think, particularly when it comes to male voters who heavily supported Tiffany Smiley over Patty Murray. But, you know, women voters have a lot of pull, and this was an election where the votes of women really mattered, and women really turned out in large numbers to support candidates who support abortion and reproductive rights access. And in our U.S. House races, there was a lot of discussion about, oh, will any of these Democratic incumbents be overturned? And in fact, that didn't happen. Democratic incumbents are going to return to the U.S. Congress in districts 1, 2, 6, 7, 9, and 10. Those really are no surprise because in a standard election year, those Democratic incumbents would typically take, you know, between 60 and 70 or 80 in the case of Jayapal here in Seattle in District 7. I think they would take those somewhere between 60 and 80% of the vote. Now, also, Democrat incumbent Kim Schreier in District 8 beat back a challenge by Republican Matt Larkin by 53% versus 47%. That one was closer than the Patty Murray Tiffany Smiley race, but Schreier still seemed to beat Larkin pretty handily there. And that is really good news. Now, the close race in Washington State is in District 3. That's in Southwest Washington around Vancouver and the suburbs of Portland, just across the Portland, Oregon, which is just across the border. That's the district where Democrat Marie Glusenkamp-Perez is currently leading the Trump-backed Republican candidate Joe Kent by just a little over 5,000 votes. So that one is going to be a squeaker for either one of them. And it's looking like Glusenkamp Perez may flip that district from Republican control to Democratic control. So that race is probably the most interesting one, and our home state illustration of what's wrong with the Republican Party right now, because that district, the incumbent in that district was Jamie Herrera Butler, who appeared to be have a pretty strong position within the Republican Party, but she was not a huge fan of Donald Trump. So Trump backed a challenger in her race, Joe Kent.
Unknown.
Yeah, complete unknown, someone with no experience, very extreme in his political views. And
questionable employment.
Appears to have made up the names of companies that he worked for. So voters could have almost no confidence in him at all. And yet, because he was backed by Donald Trump within the Republican Party, which here in Washington State tends to mean people who may be having a little trouble with their logic, the logic processes in their brain. He was able to beat Jamie Herrera Butler in the primary and go on to the final against a credible and, very fine candidate fielded by the Democrats, Maria Glusenkamp Perez. And now she's flipping that district to blue. So hopefully that she'll be able to maintain that margin. I wouldn't put it past Joe Kent, however, to challenge the results of the vote. That appears to be a strategy that many Trump-backed candidates are going to be using during this election cycle. But here in Washington State, we have a pretty good way of recounting and certifying the vote. So even with a challenge by Kent, if Perez is able to maintain her lead in District 3, she's likely to head to Congress next year. Now, of course, in our two Republican incumbents in Eastern Washington in Districts 4 and 5, that's Dan Newhouse and Kathy McMorris Rodgers, they will be returning to Washington, D.C. as well. So that's what the Washington State elections look like. We're returning our Democratic senator and 8 instead of 7 of our 10 House representatives are going to be Democrats versus 2 instead of 3 Republicans. Now, if we look at the more local races, so the statewide race for Secretary of State, this race is still really close, but it looks like incumbent Democrat Steve Hobbs appears to be holding off a challenge by the nonpartisan Julie Anderson by about 74,000 votes. Now, there's still a lot of votes to be counted in Washington State. It's going really slowly this year because of requirements to verify signatures on ballot envelopes. And if you're concerned about whether or not your ballot was counted, I urge you, if you kept that little strip of paper that's at the top of your ballot and where it says tear off this strip before you mail your ballot, and if you kept that little strip, or even if you didn't keep that little strip, you can go to the Washington State Secretary of State's website, and then you can verify that they received and counted your ballot. I think it's either that or it's the King County elections, one of the two, where you can go and verify that they counted your ballot. And I would urge you to do that, because if they're holding it because they can't confirm the signatures, you can still contact them. If you have that strip with the number on it, you can still contact them and verify that that is your actual ballot, and you can get your vote counted.
There's a item on the ballot, on the envelope for the ballot, where you can put in your contact info if you so choose.
And I always urge people to enter your cell phone number in the phone number section, so that they can send you a text if it appears that they have questions about your ballot. So once again, that Secretary of State race is close, but I don't think Anderson will be able to overcome that 74,000 vote lead that Democrat Steve Hobbs has. Now, the state legislature in Washington State looks like it's going to still be under the control of Democrats in both houses. The question is just by how big a margin And it seems to me that that margin could grow this year by a few seats, especially in the House. Here in the Seattle area, in some races, the question is not, you know, are we going to flip any seats from a Republican to Democrat? The question is which Democrat of the two options is winning, particularly which one of the two is more progressive. And there are three Senate races and four House races where I think that was really in question. In the three Senate races, State Senator for District 32, which is in Northwest Seattle Shoreline in Edmonds, incumbent Jesse Solomon is winning in that race over Patricia Weber by about 74% of the vote. So in that race, it looks like the better financed, backed by the mainstream Democratic Party candidate is beating the progressive challenger. In the District 36, that's my district, Queen Anne Magnolia Ballard in Northwest Seattle, Noel Frame is winning easily over the fake Democrat Kate Martin. Frame is taking 84% of the vote in that race, so voters were not fooled by Kate Martin's attempt to pose as a Democrat. In District 46 in Northeast Seattle, Javier Valdez took 85% of the vote over a young unknown Democrat Matthew Gross. So those are the results for the state Senate locally. For the state House of Representatives locally, in District 34, position one, that's West Seattle and Vashon Island, Emily Alvarado won about 70% of the vote over Leah Griffin in that race. For state representative in District 36, again, my district, Queen Anne, Magnolia, Northwest Seattle, for position one, that's the seat that Noel Frame gave up to run for the state Senate. The better funded Julia Reed has 74% of the vote over Jeff Manson. Remember, a week or two ago, I was looking at who these folks were collecting their campaign money from. Julia Reed had tapped a whole bunch of different supporters of the Democratic Party, but also several lobbying groups that support different industries that do business in the state of Washington, whereas Jeff Manson appeared to be drawing more from individuals and from his family connections. So Reed appears to be winning 74% of the vote in that district.
All right, so lobbyists will have
yeah
table.
Yeah, no surprise, right?
Right, that's normal.
That's pretty normal, yeah. If we're State House of Representatives in District 37, position two, and this is probably the closest local race here for the House of Representatives. Chipolo Street has 55% of the vote with just under 4,000 more votes than community organizer Imijah Smith. Again, there's a lot of votes left to be counted, and this one could be a squeaker for either one of them, and it could flip. Later votes in Washington State tend to be more progressive, so I'm not ruling out a win by Imijah Smith yet. That's the race that we need to be checking back on and seeing what the final result is. Now, for state representative in District 46, position two, again, I think that's your district, Mike.
It is.
Daria Farivar is 57% of the vote over Lilac Rave with a little over a 7,000 vote margin. And I really think at this point it's unlikely that Rave will overtake her. But again, that's another one we'll probably revisit just to confirm the winner in that race as well. In that position, Farivar is the more progressive candidate. So it's nice to see when we look at these different races that the progressives do occasionally win.
Mm-hmm.
And to not be discouraged when, I voted for someone and they didn't win. Now for the county candidates, the big race in King County was the King County Prosecuting Attorney's Office. In that race, it was nice to see Lisa Mannion is not a progressive per se, but she does at least have some some background in the prosecuting attorney's office. She does know what the job will entail, and she's not likely to make any major changes, particularly changes that will benefit the King County Sheriff's Office versus the fair functioning of the local judicial system. Lisa Mannion is well ahead of Jim Farrell, taking 56% of the vote to his 43%. So again, even with a bunch of votes in King County still to be counted, I don't think Farrell is going to be able to overtake Lisa Mannion in that race. Now, as for the ballot measures, King County Charter Amendment Number 1 was to move elections for county executive, assessor, and council members to even-numbered years when there's a higher voter turnout. The yes part of the yes selection is winning by 70%. So it looks like that change will be made, and that we won't be having these odd elections anymore for King County Executive Assessor and King County Council members. So that's good news. Mm-hmm. King County Proposition Number 1, that was to renew the county's parks and open spaces levy, called the Conservation Futures Program. That one is also passing with a very high vote count. The approved is winning by 69%. So again, King County residents turning out to say, yes, we value our green spaces. And it's super important for the county to continue working on things like fish habitat, on returning abandoned lands back to a wild state, on expanding parks and obtaining new parklands. Here in Seattle, we had Proposition number 1A and 1B with a two-part vote. Now, the second part of that two-part vote, it looks like 1B for ranked choice voting took the overwhelming lead. As of last night, it had 75% of the vote. So approval voting went down in flames here in Washington, here in the city of Seattle. But the really close vote here is on question 1, which asks the voter whether Seattle should change its system of voting at all. And right now, the no answer is very slightly ahead by just over 1,000 votes. And again, there are enough votes that haven't been counted yet that could easily flip to the yes answer, in which case we'd have ranked choice voting in our next primary election right now. But if no stays ahead, then we'll have no change and we'll continue to have the top two primary. So it's interesting to see this, because if the no vote wins and the lead is very, very slender, then that means that we could see a future initiative for ranked choice voting in itself, similar to the approval voting initiative. And if that's the case, then it won't be a two-part question next time. It would be simply, do you want ranked choice voting or not? And then it would be interesting to see if that passes, because it looks like here in Seattle, enough people who were informed about the differences between ranked choice voting and approval voting went for ranked choice voting. And I have to say that the way the question was asked, when you give people who don't know the difference between 1A and 1B the choice of do you vote for 1A or 1B, how many do you think are just going to choose 1B? Right. Typically, they just say, OK, 1A. Right. In this case, I think enough people who voted, and it doesn't look like a much smaller number voted on question 2 than voted on question 1. It looks to me like enough people understood the logic of the question that they voted on both, which I thought was very encouraging. But it looked to me like enough people were informed about the differences between the two that they went for ranked choice voting. And I find that very encouraging, and also an affirmation of the reasons why I love living in Seattle is that we're a progressive metropolitan area, and we care about our politics and we care enough to consider a question like this and make an informed vote. I really like that. Okay. So I'll talk a little bit about the Seattle Municipal Court judges. There were two positions in the Seattle Municipal Court that had more than one candidate. One of them is position three, where the challenger, Pooja Vadadi, which I thought was the more progressive candidate, is winning over the incumbent, Adam Eisenberg, with a comfortable 59% of the vote. So even in late returns, I don't think Eisenberg is going to make up that difference. So that's some good news. We have a progressive candidate who will be taking a position on the Seattle Municipal Court. And then in position seven, the incumbent, Damon Shadid, who has been in charge of the alternative to prosecution, the alternative courts to prosecution, has been working a lot with diversion programs. He faced a challenge by Nijat Rose Akins, and progressives were worried that he would be overturned and kicked off the municipal court. He is actually winning with 70% of the vote, so an even larger margin than Vadadi. So that was also very reassuring that people value his work on the community court and other diversion courts, rather than, you know, simply forcing everyone through Seattle Municipal Court and criminalizing all behavior, including, say, for example, you know, public intoxication.
Mm-hmm.
So, or homelessness.
Right.
So that was really good news to see that the two progressive candidates who were facing a challenge in the Seattle Municipal Court were supported by Seattle voters.
Yeah.
And I just want to point out that there are still an estimated 216,000 votes to count in King County. That's a lot of votes, right?
That's a lot.
Yeah, that's about one quarter of the votes. And there are still over 462,000 votes statewide to be counted, about 15% of the total. So some of these results may change. And if they do, we'll revisit them next week. Hopefully within a few days, we'll have closer to 80% of the votes in King County counted rather than 75%. Or perhaps closer to 90%, so that we'll know for sure about these races. But it's just kind of presenting them to you as they stand as of Friday night. Now, again, the races to watch are State Representative District 37, Position 2, Chipolo Street, and Amija Smith. That's very, very close. We also want to watch the Seattle Proposition numbers 1A and 1B, particularly the answer to question 1, should Seattle change its form of voting? Those are the two really, really big ones that I think could flip.
Yeah. Wow. So, well, we knew it was going to be exciting.
Yes.
But I have to say that it came out much better than I was imagining.
I know. I was kind of gearing up for being disappointed on yeah. Tuesday, particularly when I was looking at the national election results. And I have to say, I was very relieved at what I saw. And we'll talk about that here in just a bit. I want to first tackle another local issue, the city redistricting here.
All right,
in the city of Seattle.
It's kind of tangential to this.
It is a little bit. It's a very interesting question, one that a lot of people have a pretty high stake in. So every 10 years, there's a new national census. And when the census is completed, Seattle needs to do a redraw of the district boundaries for the Seattle City Council races in order to even out any changes in population growth over that 10-year period. What the Seattle Redistricting Commission found was with the 2020 census that a couple of districts, District 3, which is Shamasawan's district on Capitol Hill, First Hill, grew a lot more than other districts. And so especially did District 7, which is Andrew Lewis's district, which is downtown Belltown, lower Queen Anne and Magnolia. So then it became a question of, okay, how do we redraw the district boundaries to allocate some of those folks into other districts? So District 7 had to shrink in geographic size. District 3 had to have its boundaries shifted a little bit. So what we found is that District 3 gave up a chunk of its in the map that was voted on and adopted by the redistricting commission on Tuesday. The new map is very, very similar to the draft that I talked about a couple of weeks ago, with very few final changes in it. And it shifts the boundaries for District 3 north, the southern boundary north a little bit, to give some territory to District 2, Tammy Morales' district. Her district will also pick up the entirety of the international district instead of just half as it had before. And it'll pick up the top part of Yesler Terrace area versus just having a portion of that. So it makes those two neighborhoods whole in the redistricting scheme, which was one of the goals of the commissioners, was to make sure that there aren't any neighborhoods that are split down the middle, particularly neighborhoods that have people of color in them or that have lower income folks, since that in our minds would be, and you know, in any progressive area really would be, a violation of the Voting Rights Act. Now, District 7 loses most of its southern portion around Pioneer Square to District 1, Lisa Herbold's district, which is West Seattle, south to the southwest border of Seattle. And her district picks up some territory from District 2, including SoTo and Georgetown. And then District 7 also loses a chunk from its northwest area, a portion of West Magnolia, which now is part of District 6, which is Dan Strauss's district, which is northwest Seattle, north of the Ship Canal. So Ballard, Crown Hill, Fremont, Wallingford, et cetera, Greenwood area. So that's very interesting, because it was that piece of giving away the western half of Magnolia that caused a debate at the very end, when one of the commissioners voted against the map, and that was former Seattle Mayor Greg Nichols. Nichols, I think, once again proved his bias for rich homeowners by objecting to that boundary change in District 7 that splits Magnolia along 28th Avenue West. He said, quote, "Retribution against Magnolia because it is an older, wealthier, and whiter community, I think that's not something that the Redistricting Commission ought to be engaged in," end quote.
Wow.
Yeah, so I found it really interesting that he thought splitting up a large, what is a very, very large, not really contiguous neighborhood. 28th Avenue West is the ridgeline on Magnolia, and when you go west of that line, you're really looking at a lot of single family houses that are view properties, so very wealthy homeowners. And if you go east of that line, you're looking at much denser housing, a lot more apartment buildings, and folks who are lower income. And I thought that essentially he was saying, well, just because we geographically call it one area, it needs to stay one area. That does not a neighborhood make. Okay. You know, so I really agreed with the other members of the redistricting commission when they said, yeah, you know, there is very definitely a split here in the characteristics of this neighborhood, and it follows this geographic ridgeline. So we will use that ridgeline as a boundary. It was really former mayor Greg Nichols who said, gosh, no, it should all stay together. Keep those wealthy white homeowners in District 7 where they can, try to unseat one of the more progressive city council members, Andrew Lewis, who represents the downtown Belltown Queen Anne Magnolia area. So that's, I found that really, really interesting. And you know, it's worth reminding folks too that when Greg Nickels was mayor of Seattle, that was when the homelessness crisis first started to really ramp up in Seattle. And, the very first official tent encampment that was set up here in the city of Seattle was named Nicholsville for a reason. Okay. And he exhibited his bias for wealthy white homeowners then, and he's exhibiting it now. So I thought that was very, very interesting and also very illustrative of what many folks of color and lower income renters and other folks have had to deal with redistricting and how boundaries are drawn for redistricting to kind of see pushback from someone, a wealthy white person like Nickels himself, pushing back and saying, oh no, we can't change how we do redistricting because then that's discriminating against me. Without really saying, okay, well, how, you know, how is using the ridgeline a very strong geographical boundary discrimination against you as a privileged white man?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I thought that was very, very interesting.
Yeah, fascinating.
Yeah. And so if you want to take a look at the new map, there's an interactive map at the Seattle Redistricting Commission's website. You can Google them and find their website, or you can go to www.seattle.gov/redistricting is the name of their website. And just click on the how to participate link at the top, and then you'll see and then if you scroll down a little bit, you'll see the final city council district plan. You can click on that and it should open up into an interactive map that you can zoom in on to see the actual boundaries for the different districts to find out if you are in your same district. So, because you never know, you could now be in a different district supporting with a different, starting in January, a different city council member representing you.
Yeah. All right.
Okay. So that's the local news for this week.
Okay. On to national news that was kind of slow this week.
It was all about the elections, right? And a lot of it was, yeah, a lot of it was about how members of the Republican Party are now turning on Donald Trump. And I would say, finally.
About time.
Yes. It's about time that Donald Trump is on the outs with the Republican Party, right? There was a lot of course, in the national meeting, a whole lot of expectation that the Republicans would pull an upset in the midterm elections, because that's typically what the opposition party does in between, on the election cycle in between presidential elections. Now, Americans have a tendency to prefer gridlock in Congress and between the president. I don't know if it's a form of spectator sport to just kind of watch the tusslings of the president versus Congress, or if it's just the idea that less change is better. But Americans, and this may be true elsewhere, it may be a feature of humanity in itself. We want to see debate, and we want to see a fight over issues so that all sides are considered, right? Though I would argue that when it comes to politics here in America, not all sides get represented in Congress.
Definitely.
Right. I thought it really interesting with this election that it appears Trump has so deeply damaged the Republican Party that the predicted red wave was given several new nicknames. My favorite this week being the red puddle, and didn't really materialize. In addition, the Republican platform now contains some really poisonous stuff that voters turned out in droves to reject, in particular banning abortion, attempting to restrict voting access, and the denial of climate change. I think those really drove a lot of Democrats and progressives to the polls in this off-season election, which was very interesting. So really, it's not just Trump. It is also the Republican Party itself. So let's talk a little bit about the two houses, the Senate and the House. In the Senate, the Democrats have clearly won 49 seats as of last night, and they just need one more seat to maintain a majority, because Vice President Kamala Harris can vote for the Democrats to break a tie. And there are two Senate races that are still very close. One is in Nevada, where Republican Adam Laxalt, a Trump supporter, is leading the Democrat incumbent Catherine Cortez Masto by just 1,398 votes. That was as of Friday night. So it appears that that one could flip to Cortez Masto, or it could become a Republican seat. It's not clear. That one is the election that has everybody kind of on tenterhooks. And then in Georgia, it will go to a runoff in December, because neither of the two main candidates won a majority in that race. So there's going to be another vote on, I believe it's December 7th. To find out if Raphael Warnock will beat Herschel Walker in that race. I should point out that it looks like Warnock has about 40,000 more votes than Walker, even though neither of them got at least a 50% majority. So once the third party candidate is off the slate, then it looks to me like Warnock may win that one. But again, that one could be very, very close.
Yeah, you got to imagine that both sides are going to be pouring a lot of resources,
a lot of money into that runoff election in Georgia. Yeah. So a repeat of 2 years ago.
Yeah.
On that one. But yeah, no. So there was no big red wave that allowed the Republicans to take over the Senate. And that, I think, has been the most disappointing thing for the Republican Party in this election. But then there's also the House. The Republicans were really hoping to turn a whole bunch of seats in swing districts to their advantage, but that doesn't appear to be happening. Now, to have a majority, one party needs 218 seats. As of Friday night, the Republicans were projected to have 211 seats and the Democrats 200, with 24 seats still too close to call. And if the Democrats lose control of the House, which does appear to be possible and perhaps likely depending on your perspective, the Republicans will still find it really hard to get legislation passed with the very slim majority that they'll have. Plus, they won't control. They are likely to not be controlling the Senate. I think what's really interesting is that of the 9 seats that Democrats have lost to Republicans so far, 4 of those were in New York. Now, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who is a progressive representative from New York, had something interesting to say about that. She said it was because of the ossification of the New York Democratic Party apparatus. And I agree with her. I think there's some truth to that, because many of the new Democrats entering the House this year are younger progressives like AOC herself. So it's really interesting that in this election in particular, we're seeing more of that generational turnover within the Democratic Party in the individual races themselves, but not necessarily within the party ranks and the people within the party who determine number one, how to raise campaign money and from whom, and number two, where that money gets spent and who gets supported with it. So I think Ocasio-Cortez's point is that it's not just policy that's the problem when it comes to these local elections for the House. The problem is that the New York Republican Party apparatus is not spending enough money to support those younger progressive candidates against their Republican challengers. So in those swing districts, a lot of those seats were lost to Republicans. Now, one of the interesting things about Donald Trump and the Republican Party, too, is that many of the candidates for the House and the Senate that were Republicans who won their seats are election deniers. Just a ton of election deniers who are going to be going into the House of Representatives and the Senate. That was by design. Donald Trump wanted to spend a lot of money on getting people elected into Congress. And I think the plan is that when he runs for president in 2024, that he was hoping during these midterms for the Republicans to get control of Congress and that the Republican Party be dominated by election deniers so that in 2024, it wouldn't matter whether or not he won the electoral vote. That if he had a Congress he could control, they would just crown him president. Mm-hmm. I think that was the plan because he is deeply disappointed. However, a number of the Republicans going into Congress next year are election deniers. So that's going to be very, very interesting and something to look at. One of the things that I found as kind of the flip side of that coin, that is kind of the one of the good things that happened during this election cycle, is that even though Donald Trump supported a lot of governors, a lot of Republican candidates for governor and for Secretary of State who were election deniers, not as many of those folks got elected this year as were elected to the U.S. Congress. And I found that kind of interesting. And I think it says something about local politics versus national politics. And maybe it says something, too, about not just about voters and what voters prioritize in their local politicians versus their national politicians that they send to Congress, but also may reflect the amount of money that Donald Trump put towards supporting these candidates for U.S. Congress versus candidates for more local offices like governor and secretary of state. It was particularly interesting to me that voters rejected for Secretary of State positions any kind, and a lot of the candidates that Trump supported who were election deniers. So voters were pretty savvy, I think, about, okay, the Secretary of State manages the elections, they count the ballots, they deal with voter access, they deal with voter information and misinformation. And we don't want somebody in that office who isn't going to count votes or is going to decertify, you know, a large number of votes just because, you know, they come from a certain neighborhood, right? Mm-hmm. Or who's going to shut down and make ballot boxes less available and polling place and close polling places, et cetera. I think voters were pretty savvy about that. But also it could be, too, that Trump put his money where his mind was, which was getting himself reelected and put much more money into those races for U.S. Congress versus these races for Secretary of State and governor's races.
Yeah.
So I thought that was kind of interesting. I also want to talk, too, about the fact that a lot of voters turned out on specific issues. For the Republicans, a lot of the voters turned out to vote for candidates because of inflation and the economy. But for Democrats, the blue wave of voters who turned out put abortion and reproductive rights as their number one concern. And I think this is probably the first election in a very, very long time where that was the case. Nationwide, there were two states that had ballot measures that would have limited abortion. One was Kentucky, a mostly red state, mostly Republican state, had an anti-abortion amendment that was soundly rejected by voters in this red state. It was an amendment very similar to the one that was rejected this summer by Kansas voters back in August during their primary election, another very red state. So here you have not just Democrats, but also Republicans, particularly Republican women, but, men as well, going to the polls and saying, this is our top issue. We're not voting for this,
mm-hmm.
which I thought was amazing. Also in Michigan, there was a ballot initiative to add to the state constitution the right to an abortion. That was also passed by a majority of voters in Michigan. And that one prevents an older 1931 law from taking effect that would ban abortion in Michigan. So another win for abortion access and reproductive rights in Michigan. And then in two Democratic states, in California and Vermont, voters passed amendments to their state constitutions to protect abortion access, something that was expected, but still quite good news. And then in other races that would affect reproductive rights, Republicans failed to elect enough candidates to the North Carolina state legislature to override vetoes by their Democratic governor, Roy Cooper. North Carolina then will remain one of the very few places in the southeastern United States where women can still get access to an abortion. So again, voters in a state that often has Republican wins, particularly in their local races, the Republicans failed to get a veto-proof majority there in their state legislature. Now, there were three governor's races where the Democrats will be able to veto anti-abortion bills. So it was good to see those Democrats win those three governor's races. Josh Shapiro in Pennsylvania, Tony Evers in Wisconsin, again, a state that's flipping red in most of its races, but not when it comes to the governorship. And Laura Kelly in Kansas, again, that state that rejected an anti-abortion law in August. They're all projected to win in those states. Now, the same could be true in Arizona if Katie Hobbs wins the governor's mansion in Arizona. She currently has about a 31,000 vote lead. So I don't think it's likely that her Trump-backed Republican opponent will win in Arizona. So some more good news there. Mm-hmm. Pro-choice groups are working on passing amendments to protect the right to abortion in more states. So they've been boosted by their wins in Kansas and Kentucky, and are looking at some other red states where they think they could pass amendments to the state constitutions to ensure the right to abortion. And that includes some very deeply conservative states like Florida, which has gone completely Republican of late. Oklahoma is another state, and then Missouri and Ohio as well are going to be battlegrounds, I think, for amendments on reproductive rights. In addition, a Democratic group called the States Project, it's actually a group that's aligned with the Democrats and probably is more that Democrats who want to deal with that issue you and I just talked about, where the money typically has been supporting, mainstream, big national incumbent Democrats, but not so much progressive Democrats and Democrats in local races. Mm-hmm. This group, the States Project, has been piling money into state legislature races. And they're actually the group that's behind the effort that held off Republicans in North Carolina. They're looking at ways to support Democrats being elected to state legislatures who will support Democratic priorities, particularly the access to reproductive rights. So, and then I should point out that during this election cycle, Democrats shored up a majority in the state legislatures in Michigan, Minnesota, and Pennsylvania, looking to the future and to fending off anti-abortion bills in those states. So that's some really, really good news this year. Yeah. So, when we make jokes about how, we've got one item this week that's good news, I think this week is making up for some of those past weeks where we didn't have a lot of good news.
Yeah. Yeah, this is pretty much an entire year's worth.
Yeah.
If you count up.
But
sorry,
like
if you discount them individually.
Yeah, but like I've said in the past, you know, the election is just the start. Once you get some decent candidates into office, it's very, very important for their constituents, that's you and me and everyone we know, to be contacting them about what you think their priorities should be and contacting them to support specific bills that come up for their vote and asking them to sponsor specific bills. So it's really, really important that constituents maintain contact to these candidates. And that we keep them honest.
Oh, yeah. How are they going to get all those great ideas unless our listeners contact them and tell them, you know, how to fix everything?
Exactly. Well, they represent you. Never forget that. They represent you. They don't represent themselves or major corporations, even if maybe they took a lot of money from major corporations or lobbying groups. Remind them, hey, I hire and fire you. Not them. So.
And speaking of hiring and firing, the youth vote this election, which was totally disparaged by a majority of the media prior, appears to have been a major factor in the results.
Yes, and I think in particular, seeing the Supreme Court overturn Roe v. Wade really shocked a lot of younger folks. Made them think about, gosh, what kind of country am I living in? Am I living in a dictatorship? What, you're going to take away a right that has been available since before I was born, you know? So yeah, the fact that the mainstream media disparaged young voters, I found to be, you know, ageist and sexist, because I think a lot of the younger folks who voted were women in particular. Mm-hmm. And that it's very, very important once the opposition party, the Republicans, and their supporters start talking about taking away basic human rights, that voters show up and say, nope, not happening on my watch. Yeah. So that was also another really positive thing that happened during this election cycle.
One last quick thing.
Oh, yeah.
The runoff, the Senate runoff in Georgia is December 6th.
December 6th. Yes. Okay. Let's talk a little bit about the disaster, the evolving disaster at Twitter. It's been both entertaining to watch and like a slow motion car wreck, right? With Elon Musk making users pay for the blue verified account checkmark, and then just a couple of days later suspending that after fake parody accounts paid the $8 a month to get their spoofed accounts verified, and then went on to do some pretty serious damage, including spoofing major corporations like Eli Lilly and posting a message saying, hey, we're giving away insulin for free, which then went on to cause Eli Lilly's stock price to drop precipitously and cost the company millions, if not billions of dollars. They spoofed accounts like PepsiCo, Nintendo, Tesla, and even Elon Musk himself. So, you know, just kind of a sign of the chaos at Twitter right now. Now, when Musk took control of Twitter, he fired half of Twitter's employees, and many, many others have resigned, including the head of trust and safety, which doesn't exactly cause people to actually trust Twitter at this point, but also the entire top executive team. And in fact, there were so many people fired and so many other people who resigned that we're starting to hear stories about technological failures at Twitter offices, where some systems failed to work and no one was available or still employed who knew how to fix them, mm-hmm. which is, I think, the sign of a company that is becoming a sinking ship. Now, in buying Twitter, Musk saddled the company with about $12 billion in debt in a move that allowed him to not take on the debt personally, but to add that debt to the company's balance sheet, the company that he was purchasing. So when he tweets about how the company is hemorrhaging cash, it's kind of like a Homer Simpson moment. You kind of want to smack him and say, well, what did you expect? You just saddled it with $12 billion in debt. And then, of course, in the meantime, because he's fired most of the staff who involved in weeding out fake accounts and then pretty much threw the doors open and said anyone can now rejoin Twitter. Twitter has now seen a huge increase in fake accounts, parody accounts, and new accounts for set up by conspiracy theorists, white nationalists, and purveyors of fake news. So if you're looking for a place where you can find out what Russian bots say, Twitter is your go-to place. And Musk seems just intent on destroying the company using a sort of disruptor ethos that's wreaking havoc on its bottom line, but also driving away users and driving away advertisers. Right after meeting with advertisers in New York, Musk turned around and fired the two most trusted Twitter employees that advertisers were working with, folks who had really deep contacts with the companies that advertise the most on the platform. So once again, and that along with the spoof accounts for a lot of these companies has caused many of those companies to say, okay, I'm done advertising on Twitter. What I think is coming down the road is lawsuits against Elon Musk himself for making changes at Twitter that are actually driving down the stock price of companies like Eli Lilly and causing major disruption to their finances and costing them millions, if not billions, of dollars. And, you know, it's not as if there aren't alternative social media platforms. There's Facebook, there's Instagram, there's TikTok, and now there's a new one called Mastodon, which is a direct competitor with Twitter, and that appears to be growing quite quickly. It's entertaining to watch, but it's also, I kind of want to cover my eyes and go, I can't bear it.
Yeah.
He's just destroying, literally steering the ship onto the rocks.
Well, I think you compared it to a slow motion car wreck when you started talking about this. And I was picturing the specific type of slow motion car wreck is like those car wrecks that occur, in the Midwest in winter in thick fog where it's just like, and it turns into these mile long pileups with each car smashing into the one in front of it. And you just hear that for like hours.
Yeah, each dramatic change that he makes causes all these other things to break. And, that's maybe a sign that he's in way over his head.
He does flippant responses to people mm-hmm. that bring this up. And, it's not as heartwarming and endearing as he perceives it to be.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Like his troubles with the FTC, Twitter is under a consent decree with the Federal Trade Commission. And there are certain terms of that contract that Twitter must meet. Well, Musk has fired the people who were involved in, meeting the terms of those contract. And, the folks who are left are scrambling to try to figure out what they need to do and to provide the FTC with the information that they're supposed to be providing. Musk said that rather than bringing in a legal team to oversee that, he just thinks that those engineers can, I don't know, I guess submit whatever and it'll be fine. And the FTC has to accept that. The Federal Trade Commission, on the other hand, has warned him, look, if you're out of compliance, that's a serious problem. And I think he may reach a point with the Federal Trade Commission where it's not just an issue of levying fines. It's also an issue of the survival of the company and his ability to do business in the United States. The FTC is not somebody you mess around with.
All right. Well, we're going to have to leave it on those words mm-hmm. for this week.
Okay.
Don't mess with the FTC because we're out of time.
Okay. That's fine.